Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Susan Sweeney Crum. Coming up in a few minutes, Kristen Espelon has more on Kentucky's best bet for alternative energy. First, since April, there's been controversy surrounding the safety of a proposed police storage facility near the Cardinal Hill Reservoir in Louisville. This month, the mayor's office agreed to look at other sites for the facility. As Gabe Bullard reports, the arguments could be more explosive than the structure itself.
The explosive magazine would be back in this area.
At the Cardinal Hill Reservoir site, Lieutenant Rich Sohan with the Louisville Bomb Squad looks out at the center of the controversy.
There's a bermed wall, an earthen wall, about 600 feet away from where we're standing right now.
Underneath that wall is a reservoir. The structure that would go on the surface, 600 feet behind it, has been called a bomb storage facility and a bomb shelter. But officially, it's a Type 2 storage magazine. As such, it will follow federal guidelines and not store more than 50 pounds of explosive material. Councilman Doug Hawkins says that's too much to put near South Louisville's water supply.
The problem is, what kind of a seismic wave would it create? You know, would some kind of a seismic wave compromise the reservoir?
In order to cause damage to that reservoir, which is underground, you would have to be able to have a charge subsurface which would send all that energy to there in order to damage that reservoir. It would take a lot more than 50 pounds in order to do that.
Sohan says the facility will temporarily store materials the bomb squad confiscates and doesn't consider dangerous enough to detonate. That means fireworks, weapons, and the occasional dynamite, grenade, or antique war shell. Hawkins doubts the materials will be that benign.
It's not Jerry's cherry bomb squad, it's the bomb squad. They handle, you know, very serious, very deadly munitions.
We gave out a list to every one of the 26 council members that showed the kinds of stuff that had been in the sheds that we have today.
Mayor Jerry Abramson says that list doesn't include
nuclear devices, anthrax, bombs, hydrogen. All we're trying to do is get the facts out so people can understand.
The city legally has to have a place to store bomb squad materials. The current facility doesn't meet federal guidelines, and Abramson accuses Hawkins of delaying the new storage facility by exaggerating the Cardinal Hill situation to energize his campaign for the state Senate.
Councilman Hawkins has a way of, for lack of a better term, demagoguing an issue.
Hawkins says he's not exaggerating, and the city hasn't been honest about the site. Not about the search for an alternate location, and not about what will be stored there.
Not at all. Not one iota. They have not been honest at all. This has been one exercise in deceit, and it's been controlled by the mayor and by the administration.
At the Cardinal Hill site, Lieutenant Sohan points out that if the facility were to explode, the first thing damaged would be a MetroSafe tower. If it fell, a multi-million-dollar communication system would be crippled. He says the site is as safe as any other that meets federal guidelines, and he's not alone.
My opinion is it's much about nothing. I don't think there's that big a deal there myself.
Paul Hayden is the executive vice president of RMAG, the Bardstown-based company that makes the storage units, or magazines. They sell the same facilities to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and the Armed Services. The only difference between the facilities is the locking mechanism on the door.
Magazines are built for the safe and secure storage of the contents, in this case explosives.
Hayden says accidental detonation isn't a major concern for his clients. Security is, though. It's the type of security that could be compromised if maps of the magazine's location were distributed, like they were by the city at a Metro Council meeting. It could also be compromised if the location were featured online, like it is in videos on Doug Hawkins' YouTube page. For WFPL, I'm Gabe Bullard.
You can see Gabe's footage of the proposed area for the facility at our website, WFPL.org. While the western states are firing up wind turbines and tilting solar panels to the sun, Kentucky must seek other sources of renewable energy to generate electricity. The best bet, as Kristen Espelon reports, may be biomass.
Biomass is organic plant or animal matter, and even household garbage that can be used to generate energy. Everything from sawdust to corn cobs, from animal manure to landfill gas can be turned into electricity. Biomass is attractive because when it's used to produce electricity, it's low on greenhouse gases, which contribute to global warming. But just a handful of utilities in Kentucky have started down the biomass road, and one of those has headed for the dumps. At the Hardin County landfill, Eastern Kentucky Power Cooperative's Ralph Tyree stops his truck at a dirt-covered section of dump. He points to some metal pipes sticking out of it.
Those are the gas collection wells at this site. We have a total of about 24 of them, and they're tied together into a common system.
The wells go deep into the layers of compacted household garbage, which has been stewing in the landfill.
Basically, you've got the bacteria that's feeding upon this waste.
And in the process, that hungry army of bacteria digests the waste and produces a gas called methane. And methane can be burned to produce electricity. Pipes carry that gas to a generating plant down the hill. Ralph Tyree.
We're inside the Hardin County landfill gas plant right now. This is about a 5,500 square foot facility.
Behind two panels of glass, three giant yellow engines are chugging along, combusting the methane.
They're firing this engine with it, and that generator is direct coupled to that. And it's producing the electricity at this plant.
Tyree says the plant generates about 2.5 megawatts of power, enough to power about 1,400 homes. It's capable of producing 2 or 3 times that, but Tyree says the amount of gas predicted to come from this landfill, even as it grows over time, will still be less than 10 megawatts. With the amount of garbage Americans generate each year, you'd think that firing up every landfill could solve our energy dilemma. But Tyree says that even if every Kentucky landfill were tapped, they wouldn't generate nearly enough power on their own to meet statewide demand. But other kinds of biomass could one day help meet that demand on a larger scale. For example, switchgrass. It's a tall native prairie grass that can be cultivated. 100 acres of switchgrass could produce about 750 megawatts over the course of a year. The University of Kentucky's Tom Keene says the grass is well-suited to Kentucky's climate, and it's got a range of uses.
We know that we have the soils, the fertility, the climate to grow it. We can burn it. We can make ethanol out of it.
But Keene says it can be a tough sell for farmers. The grass takes about 3 years to mature before you can harvest it. Still, he's managed to convince enough farmers to start 100 acres on plots throughout the state in a sort of experiment.
Here in Kentucky, we've just done very little to explore alternative energy sources, and this project was an endeavor to start that, if you will, to get the ball rolling by getting switchgrass established on some farms in eastern Kentucky, primarily an area that's been hard hit by the loss of the tobacco quotas that we had.
Once Keene's plots mature, he estimates they'll produce about 5 tons of switchgrass. Biomass expert Bob Smith with the Energy Information Administration says large-scale switchgrass use faces two hurdles on the production side.
You have the actual cultivation, and then you have the harvesting, transport, storage issue.
In other words, the infrastructure isn't yet in place to handle large amounts of switchgrass. Then there are hurdles, he says, on the electricity production side. Switchgrass can be combusted, but there are few biomass generators in the U.S., and those few are relatively small. The more efficient technology would be gasification. That's where biomass is heated and turned into gas.
However, that technology is probably about 10 to 15 years out. And it's largely untested.
Smith says getting investors to embrace what's untested will not be easy. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espeland.
Last week, a study released by the National Resources Defense Council said Kentuckians spend a greater percentage of their paycheck on gas than most Americans. Stephanie Sanders wanted to find out more about the study and how states can improve their ranking. She spoke with the study's co-author, Darren Lovis.
Tell me a little bit about the study itself.
Well, this is our second annual ranking of states based on the vulnerability of drivers to gas price hikes at the pump, and the second ranking is of policy responses to help to protect consumers, and we're going to actually be doing this year in and year out as far as the eye can see because of what we've seen with $4 a gallon gasoline, the remarkable activity in the crude oil markets. I mean, it's very clear that it's worth tracking what's going on in the states.
So in regard to Kentucky and Indiana, can you tell me a little bit about what you found, I guess, with those specific states?
Sure. With Kentucky and Indiana, it's unfortunately not a great story. Both states are in the top 10 in terms of vulnerability of drivers to price increases. And what that means is that drivers in both those states spend more than 6% of their income on transportation, specifically to pay for gasoline. And this actually understates the case, because this is based on 2007 data, which was before $4 a gallon gasoline. So that number is likely to be higher. In fact, it's likely to be approaching the double digits in terms of percentage of income, which combined with housing costs that people are faced with and the increasing cost of other goods, also driven up by increasing energy costs, means that there's just a bigger and bigger burden on household budgets.
What exactly does that phrase, vulnerability to gas prices, what do you mean?
Well, what we mean is that in some states, at the other end of the ranking, for example, where there are states with drivers that spend less than half of the percentage of their income on gasoline than Indiana and Kentucky drivers, drivers are more vulnerable in some states. They have less income to spend on their daily needs because they have to spend it on gasoline.
So are we just talking about poverty here?
Well, what we're talking about, there are three factors that drive this ranking. One is how much driving people have to do to meet their daily needs, and that's a function of how sprawled out development is and whether or not there are transportation alternatives. Second, how efficient the car and truck fleet is, and that's a function of, you know, how many gas-guzzling vehicles people are driving, and then three, the average income of drivers. So income is a factor. So.
Okay. So, and I would imagine to be in the top 10, all three of those factors would have to be not like there can't be just one that takes over the entire ranking.
That's right. Although we didn't actually divide up the factors and figure out which one was more important for driving a particular state up the ranking. We're thinking about doing that next year because a lot of people have asked, well, what's the most important factor that pushes states up? And we know it's a combination, but in some cases one factor may be more important than another.
Okay. So, and then you mentioned earlier that there was going to be a second study about policy response to this information, right?
Right. We actually, in the same study, we have a second ranking based on what state policymakers are doing to protect consumers and to reduce oil addiction, as the president has rightly termed it.
Okay, so how did Kentucky and Indiana do in those rankings?
Not so well, unfortunately. Both Kentucky and Indiana ranked in the lower half of the ranking. So they weren't in the bottom 10, but Indiana was 29th. In terms of states with the best policy response, and Kentucky was 38th. So both states could stand to do more to protect consumers and to reduce oil addiction.
What sorts of policies are you guys looking at when you measure that?
Well, there are three policies that are most important and that got the most weight in our ranking. We looked at a dozen policies total, but there are three big ones. One is adoption of what's called the Clean Car Rule, which California pioneered, but now 17 other states have adopted. And what this would require is that cars get cleaner over time. And guess what? A fringe benefit is that they also get more efficient over time. So that would protect consumers by allowing them to go to the gas pump a lot less often because they're driving more efficient vehicles. A second policy that matters was also pioneered by Governor Schwarzenegger in California, and that's a fuel standard which would push gasoline alternatives, such as cars that can run off of electricity, that can be plugged into the electric grid, for example, into the marketplace sooner rather than later. And then the third big policy that mattered is targets to reduce traffic growth over time. And Washington State is really the pioneer in terms of adopting that policy, and they just adopted that in April of this year. So there are states that are taking serious action, and are this ranking changed a lot from last year, the policy ranking did, which shows that there's more and more states that are using these tools, and we encourage state leaders in Indiana and Kentucky to do the same.
Are there steps being that you guys noted in your specific study, that steps that were being taken in Kentucky and Indiana that maybe weren't weighted as heavily as those top three?
Yes, with Indiana, what we see is a requirement that the state vehicle fleet be more efficient than it would be otherwise. There are some grants for research and development into better cars and better fuels, and there is also a set of incentives for retailers to provide pumps with a high blend of ethanol at them, which, of course, helps to reduce gasoline use. In Kentucky, what we see is the requirement that the vehicle fleet be more efficient for state vehicles, and those same grants that Indiana provides, the same type of grants for research and development. But there is no requirement that retailers or incentive for retailers to provide E85 pumps in Kentucky, which is why Kentucky ranks quite a bit lower than Indiana.
Has there been improvement? Because you said you had done this study last year as well. Have we gotten better, or have we fallen in these rankings, or have the government shown an interest in moving forward here, or is it maybe just being ignored?
I think in Indiana and Kentucky, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit in terms of policy that could be adopted pretty quickly. I mean, like I say, we looked at a dozen policies. Indiana's adopted three out of the dozen that we looked at, and Kentucky has adopted two out of the dozen that we looked at. I mean, so that shows that there's plenty of room for improvement. I don't think the states moved a lot from last year's ranking. Now, what's notable is that the top 10 in our ranking did change quite a bit, with Pennsylvania jumping up, and New Mexico and Colorado jumping into the top 10, because just in the past year they've adopted new policies to protect consumers.
This may not be measured in your particular report, but are there things that can be done outside of policy change?
Companies can take a leadership role by providing employees with the opportunity to commute using public transportation. Companies can also transform their fleets so that they run off of biofuels, or that so that they have more hybrids in their fleets. And individuals can also take action. It's just, what really makes a difference is when states adopt new public policy to help out. Having said that, part of what we say in the report is that states can't end oil addiction by themselves. The federal government really needs to step up to the plate. And the president has talked about this, and there has been some action, but Washington remains gridlocked. So it's good that states are jumping out and innovating with new policy to protect consumers and to get states off of oil, but we really need the federal government to step up to the plate and take more of a leadership role than it has so far.
Sure, and then, I mean, even with some of these factors that you guys measured or did the first set of rankings on, like how much driving is needed in certain states, I'm not sure that really can be changed much by policy or by, I mean, maybe the telecommuting or working from home, but that seems to be a choice you make when you choose to live someplace, right?
Well, that's true, although more people live in metropolitan areas than I think Americans realize. It's between 60 and 80% of us actually live in metropolitan areas, whether we know it or not. And in those areas, you can provide transportation alternatives. But even setting aside transportation alternatives, car and truck fleets can be made more efficient everywhere. You know, people in rural areas also drive cars and trucks, and we can provide more energy choices for fueling up those cars and trucks everywhere. In other words, if we move quickly to a fleet of vehicles that you can plug into the electric grid, then you dramatically reduce gasoline use, and the electric grid stretches out even into rural areas. So, and biofuels, those certainly can be used not just in urban areas but in rural areas. And kind of the bottom line of the report is not about reducing gas prices, although adopting these policies may have that effect because they'll reduce demand and the laws of economics say that therefore the price will drop. But they're about giving consumers the opportunity to visit the gas station less often, and every time they do, to have the experience be less painful because they don't have to fill up with quite as much gasoline. So it's basically to reduce consumer fuel bills so that no matter what happens with prices at the pump, people can just opt out of that and we can get off of the price roller coaster that we've been on for years now.
You can learn more about the study at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, Elizabeth Kramer looks at how libraries have changed over the last century. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Susan Sweeney Crum. Coming up a little later, Kristen Espelon looks into Kentucky's failure to report laws. First, Louisville's Free Public Library opened its doors 100 years ago last week. Elizabeth Kramer reports on how our expectations of the library have changed.
Where are baby's eyes? Look, they're open wide. Can you see those peepers peek, peering side to side?
Librarian Catherine Berganza reads to a group of toddlers during story time at the public library's main branch. Sheila Portilla has driven downtown from Middletown for this reading, as she does most weeks with her two children. She appreciates the books and the atmosphere at the library.
I think it's wonderful. It exposes them to other kids who are here. They get to hear stories in different voices. With the toys, they get to come in and they get to play also.
This isn't a scene that you would have found in this building 100 years ago when the library opened. Library Director Craig Buto explains.
There was a big debate before opening this library of whether or not to allow children in the door. That's not the way we think of libraries today, but back then, children in the library was not commonplace.
In 1908, the local newspaper's headline read, "Books to Read for Everybody." But that wasn't exactly true. Back then, most of the stacks were stored in an area off-limits to the public. Children were relegated to a remote upstairs room, and African Americans weren't allowed in until 1948. That was true of many other libraries built during this time throughout the country. Carol Sheffer is president of the American Library Association.
A lot of buildings were built to be beautiful edifices, and nobody worried too much about how the space was used. Now we worry a lot more about how we can make it friendly to people of all ages, kids, senior citizens, people with disabilities, new Americans.
Today, activities for all segments of the city are woven into how the Louisville Free Public Library sees its mission. Meanwhile, the library has seen other changes over a century, including some reconstruction after the 1937 flood and a fire in 1999. It has had to be wired for electricity, outfitted for computers, and even enlarged in 1969. In recent years, it has sought more funding for the entire system, including updating the main branch. Last fall, the county rejected a referendum on a tax to fund the library. Library Director Buto says the 1908 building has been wired, but the space has hardly been touched in the past century. That has limited it in meeting the demands of the newest technology and the community, which wants more areas for group learning activities.
How do we convert spaces for the use of the public, like allow more browsing, allow more access to collections, and allow more study space? We need more space where people can study together in small groups or in large groups. We need a couple more classrooms. We're seeing more and more classroom visits to the library.
While Buto says some adaptations to this space are in his strategic plan for the library system, he declines to give any details. He has until the end of this year to present that plan to Metro Council. After 100 years of service, the library system welcomes about 750,000 visitors each year. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
On June 25th, Wesley Neal Higdon shot his boss, four other workers, and himself at the Atlantis Plastics plant in Henderson, Kentucky. Police later reported that Higdon had called his girlfriend just a couple of hours before the tragedy to tell her he planned to kill his boss. The plot thickened when police revealed the girlfriend speaks little English and may have been misunderstood in interviews. Nonetheless, Kentucky law says she is not liable for failing to report a potential crime. James T.R. Jones is a professor at the Louis D. Brandeis School of Law at the University of Louisville. He told Kristen Espelon that most state laws don't hold people responsible for reporting crimes they've seen or heard about.
The majority of states say there's no liability, even if there's a child abuse statute, no civil liability for somebody who didn't report. Kentucky has never, to my knowledge, ruled on this. The premise that I take is if you have liability for not reporting, even if you're not criminally prosecuted, you have an incentive to report if you know you're going to be hit for, you know, big damages if you don't.
You said that there really aren't any failure to report laws beyond spousal abuse or child abuse.
And elder abuse. There are some states with elder abuse statutes, too.
But other than that, no state has a failure to report any other kind of crime law.
Well, Vermont has a general reporting statute, and I think Vermont's the only state in the union that does that. I mean, like the French, just to give you a comparison, the French do require reporting. And when Princess Di was in her fatal car accident, they were talking about prosecuting the reporters because instead of dialing whatever you do to dial 911 in France, they were taking pictures of her dying. And there was a lot of discussion about criminally prosecuting them for violating the French reporting law.
The reason I got interested in this is because of the recent case where the guy shot up people at his workplace and then himself. And apparently he called his girlfriend beforehand and told her he was going to kill his boss.
And she didn't tell anybody.
She didn't tell anybody.
Yeah. As far as I know, she had no obligation to do so.
Could it or should it set off any soul searching?
Yeah, I would certainly say it should. I mean, I would be all in favor of saying that she ought to have to report it. In fact, in one of the articles that I've written, I argued that. But that's not the rule. There's an early case where there was a kid who was walking on railroad tracks. This is like from like 1910 or something. And he was a trespasser, and a train ran over his severed his foot. And they stopped the train, and they basically sort of stood there and watched him bleed to death. And, you know, they tried to sue him, and the court said something like, you know, when you boiled it all down, they said when you die and, you know, appear before St. Peter, you know, it may work against you that you didn't help this kid, but there's no liability on earth. I mean, it's a horrible rule.
To come back to your original comment, which is that we really don't have any responsibility to each other necessarily unless there's a formal relationship
mm-hmm.
in place, such as, you know, mother, daughter, or some kind of caregiver and patient.
Yeah, and there's some other situations too. But yeah, basically, I mean, innkeepers have a duty to their guests. And if you're in a store, and I mean, there have been cases where, like, somebody gets their foot caught on an escalator and the store doesn't push the stop button. There's a responsibility there because you're what they call an invitee because you're on the premises to, you know, spend money. Those are the exceptions. And, you know, gradually there are increasing numbers of exceptions being recognized. But the general rule is, no, you don't have a duty to rescue or duty to act.
That was the University of Louisville law professor James T.R. Jones speaking with WFPL's Kristen Espeland. Kentucky Education Commissioner John Droud will try to purchase the fully loaded state automobile he ordered earlier this year, but later regretted. Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh has the story.
Kentucky education officials with state cars are usually issued $16,000 Chevrolet Impalas, but Education Commissioner John Droud wanted an $18,000 Chrysler 300 with $13,000 in extras like a V8 engine, a hands-free telephone, and a global positioning system. Droud initially denied knowing anything about the cost of the $31,000 car until shown emails obtained by the Louisville Courier-Journal that clearly showed he did. He later told the paper he forgot signing off on the purchase, but considered the add-on safety features because he annually drives thousands of miles for the state. but the purchase drew immediate fire from State School Board Chairman Joe Brothers, who ordered a board review.
Certainly, it does not send the signal, in my view, that we would like to send to teachers and administrators and for that matter, taxpayers and students across the state.
After meeting privately with Brothers and several board members last month, Droub publicly apologized for his actions.
I think in this particular case, I used some bad judgment. The timing certainly was not good at all with all the problems we have with budgeting. And from my point of view, if I had that to do over again, I would have done it differently.
Droub told the board he would either reimburse the state for any additional costs associated with the car's purchase or buy it outright. He's now pursuing the latter. Glenn Mitchell of the Finance Cabinet says in December, the vehicle will be declared state surplus and sold at auction on eBay.
Any auction we have has to be open. It has to be a public-type auction. So, in fairness, he would just be another bidder.
Droub says he really doesn't want or need the car. He just wants to do the right thing.
What I plan to do is bid what the total cost of the car was so that I can make sure that the taxpayer has not spent any money on that car.
But eBay is worldwide. What if he's outbid?
If I don't get it, that's fine. I prefer not to get it.
Well, if you didn't get it, then you wouldn't have the car that you want, and the next car you get may not be the same thing.
Whatever they want to give me is fine.
So if he were to be outbid, what kind of car might he receive? Glenn Mitchell.
Well, we would solicit from him, you know, what his preferences are, which is what we did before. And the reason he bought the car he did was because of the amount of travel demands that he thought he was going to have on him with that job. So we would do that again. We would solicit from him what type of car he would prefer.
Whatever they'd like for me to have, I'll accept.
69-year-old Droub was named Education Commissioner last November. He got the job despite appeals from newly elected Governor Steve Beshear for the state school board to delay or expand the search. The former Republican legislator and superintendent of Ludlow Independent Schools replaced Illinois educator Barbara Irwin, who abruptly resigned before starting work when questions surfaced about her resume. She succeeded longtime Commissioner Gene Wilhoit, who took a consulting job in Washington. Commissioner Droub faces his first performance review early next month. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Tony McVeigh in Frankfort.
When we come back, a look at Louisville and if its residents have self-sorted themselves according to their benefits. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Susan Sweeney Crum. Coming up, Stephanie Sanders talks with the author of the book Rome 1960 and why he thinks the Olympics that year changed the world. First, when Americans move, they usually look for neighborhoods with specific characteristics, whether they are close to the countryside or downtown or a place dotted with big box stores or boutiques. Some say they also move according to political views, and it's tearing the country apart. Elizabeth Kramer reports.
As Americans move house more frequently, they are becoming more politically polarized by choosing to live in neighborhoods with people who think and vote like them. So says Bill Bishop, author of The Big Sort. He describes neighborhoods throughout the country. In his neighborhood of Austin, Texas, houses sit close together, and in 2000 voted for Al Gore first, followed closely by Ralph Nader. Last week, Bishop was in his hometown of Louisville, where we rode through several neighborhoods looking for visual cues that might mark their politics. We drive through the Highlands and into Germantown. There are yard signs for Clinton and Obama, and Bishop points out other similarities.
You get here and all of a sudden the streets get narrower and the houses get closer together, and then there pops Lynn's Paradise Cafe, you know, just out of nowhere.
Bishop says people who move to neighborhoods like these generally want to live close to their neighbors and homegrown businesses and tend to have liberal views. He says changing voting patterns in presidential elections at the county level illustrate that Americans are becoming politically polarized and homogenized. In 1976, they were split almost 50-50. In 2004, 48% of counties gave their winning candidate a landslide victory of 20% or more of the vote. This kind of information is more difficult to gather at the neighborhood level, but Bishop attempts to document the concentration of like-minded political thinking through data such as education levels and the retail stores there. While driving through Pleasure Ridge Park, which has conservative leanings, Bishop notices the big box stores, like Toys R Us, and starts talking about Portland, Oregon.
When one of those shows up in their neighborhood, they think something is wrong. And a lot of times in other neighborhoods, people want those stores because they show prosperity.
Still, Bishop concedes that visual cues don't always illustrate a neighborhood's politics. Pleasure Ridge Park, with a large proportion of working-class families, is not always loyal to one party on election day. While residents tout the neighborhood's conservative values, many also have relatives who are union members, often moving them to vote for Democrats. Some political scientists say Bishop's theory isn't the only reason for this polarization. Morris Fiorina is a professor at Stanford University and author of Culture War: The Myth of a Polarized America. He says people are sorting themselves into like-minded communities, but cites a stronger source of our polarized politics.
The parties have become, in this country, more homogeneous. As the Democrats have lost the South, the Republicans have lost the Northeast, the parties are more homogeneous now than they were a generation ago, but still far less than the National Party leadership and the party activists.
Fiorina says the parties changed radically after the 1960s, when the old patronage system gave way to the strengthening of participatory procedures like primaries and caucuses. That sparked the rise of powerful interest groups, which have influenced the parties with money. The voters, he says, remain moderate, and cites Gallup poll data in which the public identifies itself as split equally among Democrat, Republican, and Independent. He says some people have extreme positions on contentious issues like abortion, but most have nuanced views that allow exceptions to the rule. So while neighborhoods are becoming more homogeneous, with some having residents who frequent locally owned cafes and others dining at Applebee's, Fiorina says all neighbors won't necessarily vote the same, especially in this presidential election, where candidates are playing more to the center. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
The first time an athlete was paid to wear a certain brand of shoes, the first widely televised Olympic Games, and the first African-American to carry the U.S. flags into the opening ceremony. They were all firsts at the 1960 Olympics in Rome. It was also the first time the world took notice of an up-and-coming boxer from Louisville who was then known as Cassius Clay. Stephanie Sanders talked with author David Marinus about his new book, Rome 1960, The Olympics That Changed the World. She first asked where he got the idea for the book.
Well, I saw in the story of the 1960 Olympics in Rome both an exciting cast of characters, immortal sports figures, including Cassius Clay, who would go on to be Muhammad Ali, winning a gold medal in Rome in light heavyweight boxing, Wilma Rudolph, the brilliant sprinter from Tennessee State, Abibi Bakila, the great Ethiopian marathoner who won in Rome running barefoot, Rayford Johnson, maybe the greatest athlete of that era, winning the decathlon, but also as a way to explore ushering in of the modern world. These were the first televised Olympics. The first doping scandal happened at these Olympics. The first athlete to get paid for wearing a certain brand of shoes happened at these Olympics. And there were very important advancements for blacks and women. So you could see so much coming into view right at that moment in Rome.
When I when this book first came across my desk and I saw the title of it, just Rome 1960, and I thought, I don't know. But then when I read inside on the leaves what all was happening, and then as I read through the chapters, I thought it was terribly interesting that you kind of happened upon all of this, because those are all the things that make a really great novel, you know, like great characters and a great setting and all these little storylines that you can weave together, and yet it's all true.
Yeah, it is all true, and I appreciate that perspective. I particularly like to hear people say, well, I'm not sure, and then get sold on it. But it did have that combination of character drama and sort of history there. And that's what I love to do, to illuminate history and sociology, using the drama of sports as the means to do it.
One of the things I noticed in your descriptions of some of these really strong characters was the different sorts of charisma maybe that draws us to athletes, whether it's and you know, when you look at people like Wilma Rudolph or Rafer Johnson or Cassius Clay, those are all different kinds of of charisma that draws us to them. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what it is that sort of entrances the public about an athlete.
Well, Wilma Rudolph was you know, both a great story and a charismatic figure and a beautiful runner. I mean, she'd overcome childhood polio and scarlet fever, leg braces as a child, teenage pregnancy, to become the shining star in Rome. And it was the first televised Olympics. Just the way she ran, the beauty of her gait, her personality sort of made her special in combination with her story. Rafer Johnson was the first African-American to carry the flag at the opening ceremony of the Olympics, a very important symbolic moment for the country during the heat of the civil rights era. He was the student body president at UCLA, a very smart guy and dignified person and a tremendous athlete. So he brought that to the table. And then Cassius Clay, you know, he was only 18 years old in Rome. He had the same personality he would have later as Muhammad Ali, but not the meaning behind it yet. He did win the gold medal in the light heavyweight boxing division, but he was kind of like the obstreperous little brother to the rest of the team. You know, they'd roll their eyes when they saw Cassius coming, knowing that he'd have some rhymes and braggadocio and all of that. So three very different personalities.
And those types of, I guess I find with each Olympics that comes and goes, there are those types of personalities that we as Americans are sort of drawn to, and usually it's with people that we maybe hadn't even heard of before the Olympics, but in the course of the games, we learn about them and watch their triumphs or failures unfold before us, and that draws us to them.
Yeah, that's very true. You know, today, though, you have thousands of hours of television coverage of the Olympics. In 1960, there were about 22 hours altogether. It seemed much sort of simpler and almost archaic then, and there were fewer athletes. So the ones that really stood out probably stood out more then than they even do now, when there's such a saturation of events and television and coverage and commercialism.
Sure, and you mentioned, I want to go back a little bit and talk some more about Cassius Clay. One of the things that struck me when I was reading one of the sections about him, I guess to people in Louisville, it's hard to imagine Muhammad Ali before he was, you know, the most famous athlete in the world.
Yeah, well,
it was good when you brought that up in the book.
He was, you know, he was a Golden Gloves guy. He was afraid to fly. They had to give him sleeping pills to get him on the plane to go to Rome. He said if God wanted us to fly, he'd give us wings. The sleeping pills didn't even shut him up. You know, he was yapping the whole way to Rome. You know, he was sort of beloved by the other athletes, but also, you know, they treat him, you know, roll their eyes when they saw him coming. He probably met every single person in the village from every country within the first 2 days, and maybe by the third day, half of them were sick of him.
So, and he was the hometown hero here,
absolutely.
But I mean, he wasn't yet on the world stage at that point.
Well, this was his entrance to the world stage, and he did it in classic Cassius Clay Muhammad Ali fashion. You know, nothing scared him aside from flying once he got there. He was bragging about how he was the greatest even then. He said he would be the heavyweight champion of the world, you know, even then at age 18. You know, Floyd Patterson, the ranking heavyweight champion of the world, came to Rome, and Ali got up on the table and started shouting at Floyd Patterson. You know, he just was the same guy he was at age 18 that he'd become later.
And then when you see that personality sort of set as a foil to Rafer Johnson, it kind of... It was interesting to me to see how different the two of them were, and yet they were both friends with each other.
Yeah, they were. I mean, Rafer Johnson was the captain of the team. You know, he didn't. He was the best athlete in Rome. Cassius Clay went on to be Ali, the most famous athlete in the world. Rayford Johnson lived a very fine life after that, but his athletic stardom diminished. He retired after Rome, and I wondered when I interviewed him whether he was in any way envious or jealous of Muhammad Ali. And he said no. He loved the guy, and he, you know, that Ali had a personality of the sort that Rayford Johnson could not have, did not want to have, but he enjoyed Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, very much.
One of the things that also I was delighted with in the book is, I guess first when I read what it was about and all the topics that were going to be covered, when I opened it, I thought it was going to be like, okay, here's the chapter on racial issues, and here's the chapter on...
Well, you've actually never read anything I've written.
Mean, you did a fantastic job of weaving all the things together, so it played out in an order that that didn't just dedicate something to one topic and then move on. It made it all one large story.
That's the way I write. I mean, I do intense research to get the material to present it as a story, a nonfiction narrative. I want the reader to follow the characters and to feel that they're there and not to just present it as a one-dimensional presentation of facts, but as a story.
The politics surrounding, or the politics that were going on in the world at that time that weren't even necessarily related to sports.
Well, I think they weren't necessarily related to sports, but I try not to impose context on a story where it doesn't belong. And the beauty of the Olympics is that it brings the entire world together, and that most of the issues of the world come through those Olympics. So that you saw the tensions of East and West Germany being played out in the Olympics when they had to compete as a so-called unified team. When you saw the tensions of the two Chinas then, Mao Zedong's mainland China and Taiwan, played out in those Olympics. When Taiwan marched into the opening ceremonies carrying a banner that said under protest because the International Olympic Committee had forced them to call themselves Taiwan instead of what they like to call themselves, the Republic of China. When you saw the issues of Black Africa played out in the Olympics, when anti-apartheid leaders from South Africa first tried to get South Africa banned from the Olympics unless it ended its discriminatory policies, and when Bibi Bikila became the first Black African ever to win a gold medal running through the streets of Rome barefooted to win the marathon, and Rayford Johnson being the first Black to carry the American flag at a time of great importance in the civil rights movement. So I try to show politics only in the sense that it really goes through the Olympics, and it's a way of using the drama of sports to illuminate history and sociology.
That was Stephanie Sanders speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning author David Marinus. His latest book is Rome, 1960, The Olympics That Changed the World. Marinus will be in Louisville Monday, August 4th, to speak and sign books at the Louisville Free Public Library. There's more information on our website, wfpl.org. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM, including WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Susan Sweeney Crum. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.